American media in the post-war era was full of monsters. Black and white movies about aliens and giant bugs gave way to full-color coverage of the trial of Charles Manson and colorful movies based on the life of isolated farmhouse-dwelling psycho Ed Gein. Sacred monsters, to borrow again from French author Georges Bataille, were all over our screens and newspapers, as visible as can be. People were primed to be scared of the monster from outer space, the inner cities, or the farmhouse in the middle of nowhere. The first thing to understand about Ted Bundy is that Ted Bundy never existed. There was no Ted Bundy. It wasn't even his name at birth. Ted Bundy was a carefully constructed fiction, which the world saw and believed for a time, even when the evidence showed it was false. He was an atom in an atomized age, a fully functioning invisible unit, invisibility being the marker, as he saw, of what it means to be a true American. People saw what they were accustomed to seeing, what Bundy wanted them to see. The imagined picture of America, as the good people of the time wanted to see it, though in actuality, he embodied fully the worst case result of its unresolved tensions and failures, past and present. Bundy was a bad seed, perhaps, but one who came to full flower because of the unwillingness at the time of the country he grew up in to look at itself honestly. He was not who he seemed to be, but instead everything we had tried to ignore. Ted Bundy baffled and terrified the United States like no serial murderer to date, because he revealed well and truly that the ruthless killer might not be a dirty hippie, black radical, or backwoods hick, but the boy next door. In the end, what was revealed in the Bundy case was there was no sacred monster lurking. The true monster was us, the true America, every bit as invisible to our own eyes then as the man known as Ted Bundy.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Golden Age of Serial Murder. It's me, Toby, and with my co-host here, Simeon. And we have today a very special guest, friend of the show, Yogi Paliwal, is here. Yogi Paliwal is a comedian from New York, although he heralds from Washington, where some of these crimes were committed. So it should be an interesting episode.
This is a big one, listeners. This is one of the biggies. Probably going to be number one at the time, one of the most iconic, if not the most iconic, serial killer of the time and maybe in American history, Ted Bundy. We'll get to some of the other contenders in later episodes, but this guy, I think, changed the way people looked at violence in this country, at least the serial murder or serial violence and threats, scary people forever.
He kind of was the beginning of serial killers are a thing and they're here. Get used to it.
Yeah, because the previous episodes we've had, every one of them was either like BTK, no one knew who he was. Dean Corll could be ignored because it's gay murders, the gay weird stuff happening in the gay community, though it wasn't that. Ed Kemper was a loser. All these things, these previous people, you could just put them aside and you could ignore it. And you couldn't with Ted Bundy because he was not just the boy next door, the ideal of what you wanted your son to be, who you wanted your daughter to marry. He was part of, ingrained in every aspect of our society and culture. He was successful, or at least on the surface. He was all these things appeared to be that he actually wasn't, but that's something we learned recently. At the time, it's like, wait a minute, this is not what a serial killer is, but that is, they're anyone, they can be anybody.
See, before it was fringe serial killers. You've got your, oh, this guy kills gays, this one only goes after albinos, but Bundy made it mainstream. He's a good old white boy, and he's killing good-looking white women. Watch out, America!
Bundy was born Theodore Cowell on the 24th of November 1946 in Burlington, Vermont, to 22-year-old Eleanor Louise Cowell. She was young and unmarried.
Yeah, I'm going to say to start off that there's a lot of, I talked to Toby a little bit about this. I don't know, Yogi, if you, what ideas you have of this. I'm going to just come out and say from my perspective, we don't know this for sure. I think that based on what I've seen of his mother, Bundy's mother. I think that in my at least I suspect very strongly. In fact, I really kind of think this, that Ted Bundy's grandfather is also his father. That the story about her going out and meeting a sailor, which she contradicts in other stories, accounts with a different name, different person. I think that was just a family cover up, and that Ted Bundy's grandfather was also his father. That's what I suspect, and we don't know for sure. But I don't know what you thought.
Sure. I mean, I cannot confirm or deny. I will say that the man's a Scorpio, and just like me, we can't be trusted. Okay.
Wild card. My mom's a Scorpio. She might say the same thing.
And when it comes to his mom and family, you know, he's born in Vermont. And Toby, what year was he born in again?
He was born in 1946.
46. So, you know, Vermont, this ain't Bernie's Vermont. You know what I mean? This is Vermont original, if you know what I mean. So he's a good old country boy. It's essentially being West Virginia or Kansas, if you ask me, Vermont in the 40s. And yeah, Simeon, I mean, you know, the thing about his mom, look, regardless of how it ended up happening, she got a bun in the oven and she ain't got no one to feed it. She's doing the best she fucking can. And I can't confirm or deny she did her best. I do know that from the one piece that I watched, the only troubling, in quotation, sign of Bundy was that as a youth, he put all of the kitchen knives on the bed facing his mother, I believe. And by facing, I mean pointing towards. Now, look, that's weird. But it ain't, you know, chopping a cow's, you know, udder off. Like, it's not violent. It's odd, but it ain't fucked up yet. And it's going to lead to my greater point later.
I can tell you, though, that A, it was actually his aunt, not his mother. But he was raised to believe that his mother was his sister and that her sister was his aunt, because the family covered this whole thing up. Whether it was because she slept with some guy and that's not done then, too, or because her father raped her or whatever. But the thing is that when Bundy did that, this is worth noting, he was 3 years old. He correctly arranged all the knives. He puts them around his aunt's body while she's sleeping and just stands there staring at her like a cat for like 8 hours, like just several hours. That was at 3 years old. I mean, the thing I think is about Bundy is we've seen this previously with Peter Curtin and with a couple, maybe other people we'll see in the future. This guy, I think, was born psychopathic and dangerous. I think that this guy is, you know, and that's kind of a complicated, it's a lot of people don't like the idea of some people can be born a certain way, rather, you know, and there are some psychologists who said he may, like his mother, have been abused by his grandfather, who was just an absolutely bullying monster of a man. Sure. But the thing is that you see some signs of certain types of dangerous personality. I mean, he is not, you're right, it's like, putting knives around someone is not the same thing as cutting them up, but staring at them unmovingly at the age of 3 for hours until they get up, then kind of enjoying watching someone be afraid that they're surrounded by kitchen knives pointing at them in surrounded, arranged in a perfect semicircle, as what was the case that he did at the age of 3. That's a very early sign of sadistic behavior, of incredible patience, of someone who has this kind of brain chemistry that makes them able to focus and be patient and not.
No, you're right about that. I can't deny that. Listen, the boy's a Scorpio. He's a freak. And
there are a lot of serial killers, by the way. Not a lot, but some of the worst serial killers in at least American history are Scorpios. There are two others, David Parker Ray and Leonard Lake, I think the two worst, and Ted Bundy is up there. There's something about Scorpios when they're not nice people. They can be very, very frightening. But it is. I noticed that actually. I know because my mother is someone who knows a little bit of astrology. So I noticed that. Wait a minute, Scorpio.
Bundy, as Simeon has said, he is raised by his grandparents. His sister is his mother becomes a sister, and he's raised by his grandfather. His grandfather, and particularly Bundy's, talked about his grandfather actually in really good terms, but other members of the family said that he was extremely fighting individual. He was physically violent and aggressive at the slightest provocation. He abused his wife, and he was blatantly racist, and actually also like kept pornographic material in the house, which Bundy was able to sneak and look at. But Bundy's described him as this like mythic figure who adored and respected and kind of wanted to be as a, as he was growing up.
Whether you'll see this with John Wayne Gacy, who I think is a very similar person, is that psychopathic people, and that's a term that is, you know, is not used as much anymore. They replace it with antisocial personality disorder, but I think that's an umbrella term. What we will describe as psychopathic people, cold, unfeeling people who love power, and more than most people, like really extreme examples, Bundy and Gacy, they both had father figures. Whether they were their father, in another case, in his case, we don't know. But these were Gacy's father and Bundy's grandfather were these monstrously violent, tyrannical figures who were adored by their psycho sons or grandsons, and no one, other people were terrified of them. But the thing is, these people like Ted Bundy and Gacy, they want to be the tyrannical figure everyone's afraid of. They grow up wanting to be that person.
I definitely feel that in terms of what Ted Bundy ends up becoming, there is an aspect of I need to be a maniacal icon. And, you know, we'll talk about this later, but when it comes to how he acts in the televised court cases to the interviews he's done with the detectives, there is a part of him that's like, I'm the one in control. And I do think that does come directly from his grandfather's inspiration.
One of the things also is that one way in which he's different from someone like John Wayne Gacy. Gacy was just called repeatedly by his father a fat little queer, will never turn up to anything. He was just insulted. Bundy didn't have this experience. What Bundy did not like that his mother, we thought was his sister, actually, you know, that home and married Johnny Bundy, I think his name was, where the name comes from. He did not like his stepfather. Because he thought that he's not a real man like my grandfather. He's, you know, he's just a little wimpy guy. He's not, you know. But I also think in the case of Ted, you wonder at what point he talks a bit like his mother's the same way. Maybe this is just the era. They talk a bit like movie stars from they imitate the diction, the 40s and 50s. I wonder if Ted, even though he was not actually friends with any of the neighborhood kids, even though he hung out and did stuff with them, wasn't really someone given to friendship. I wonder if at a certain point, growing up, he realized that he was really good looking and a classic all-American white boy. And he looked at these movie stars and idolized them too, because he is not someone like Gacy who just wants to be accepted. He wants to be almost like worshiped. He has this sense of himself that's incredibly elevated. And I guess Gacy did too when he kidnapped boys, but you know, there's just something about him. He has this ego that's fitting his image.
And there's another role model in his early life, his uncle Jack. They moved to Tacoma, Washington, to live with him for a little bit when he was 4. And Jack was an accomplished pianist and composer and music professor, actually, at University of Puget Sound. And he's although he had moved from his treasured father figure, his grandfather, he saw his uncle was a person of great accomplishment who had this aura of wealth and sophistication, and Bundy kind of that imprinted on him, and Bundy kind of wanted to be like him.
That's interesting because the one thing about Bundy you notice as he grows up is that because, and this is afforded to him in some ways because of his ability to imitate it, to appear to fit it, is that he really wanted to be, he grew up in a poor family, but he really wanted to be a blue blood in the blue blood class. He wanted to be rich. He wanted to be respected. He wanted to be adored and admired for, in part, for money. And he hated that the material possessions that his mother or sister, as he thought for a time, that his family did not possess, that other people that he knew possessed. This fits in his image, the image of him as he wants to be a blue blood aristocrat. That's who he wants to be.
There's a bit of the Jay Gatsby in him almost, which is kind of a normal American thing, especially from someone from that background who's, you know, reasonably intelligent and attractive, you know, wanting to be more than his current circumstances. But obviously, he takes it a lot further than most people do.
Yeah, I personally think that comes when he's in college, but I don't know if we're at that point of his life just yet, though. I
They're
don't
not quite.
know. Yeah, I will bring that up when we're there. I have a lot to say about that then.
Yeah, so like when he gets to school, you know, he had some bad relationships with his teachers, especially Miss Gowrie, who was like a doctrinaire Catholic. He was kind of seen as quite a violent kid, a little bit of a bully. He didn't really socialize that well with other people.
The thing is Bundy, he learns, like a lot of psychopaths, he learns how to present himself. That is who he is. He is an antisocial, violent, impulsive, dangerous person. And you see that in childhood. You actually see this. One thing he does is he sets potentially deadly traps for people in the woods. Tiger traps. He puts like sharpened stakes in covered traps. And then it really kills a girl who falls in there. He is violent towards animals. He looks like he should be able to fit in, but he doesn't fit in because he doesn't have the instinct to play with other children. He's not able to follow the rules or to, like, even in a basic children's game or baseball or something. He's athletic, but he's not good at actually adhering to the rules of group games. He doesn't get along really well because he doesn't actually understand. He said this later in interviews. He didn't understand as a child, even intellectually, why people made friends. Because he doesn't, Bundy is such a deficient person in his brain in terms of psychologically. He was smart, but psychologically, he doesn't understand why people love each other or care about each other or become friends. He only understands why you get things for yourself. He only understands the idea of being rich and loved and respected as the idea of being a god to other people. He doesn't understand being part of the human race. He doesn't understand how other people are. And he hurts other kids in the neighborhood, and he hurts animals. And it's not surprising he would scare the teachers because he was a scary person even as a kid.
There's also a story of him like masturbating in closets in school. And one time the other kids opened the door and threw like a bucket of ice on him. So yeah, clearly he wasn't that well adjusted to his adolescent environment, I guess.
You also wonder if he was imitating his grandfather there, because his grandfather, whether he is his father or not, we don't know. I think he was, but we don't know. But one thing, the grandfather would throw his mother down the stairs and her sisters. His grandfather, he had the pornography. So the first male figure in his life is this abusive guy who may have seen him doing that. Maybe he was, when he first started masturbating, he was imitating him. Who knows? But the thing is that other children in the neighborhood had more, not just a more, had more money, but had a more respectable family. I mean, and by the way, you mentioned Ted Bundy's mother. I think, by the way, just my read on her is she is a tragic, heartbreaking character in this, because I think her whole life, she's just victimized by one man after another, and she's such the good, was called by author Virginia Woolf at the time, the angel in the house, the good woman who just shoves her feelings down and gets the ice cream. And
all she needed was a room with a view, you know, to do her own thing.
Yeah, yes.
the whole masturbating closet, speaking as a Scorpio, it's just a phase. you get into it. Sometimes you're like, the bathroom's too far, I just need to get this done, there's nobody in the closet, and then you get a little addicted to it, and then all of a sudden people are throwing ice at you, and then it becomes a game, you know, kind of like when your cell phone has 3% battery, but you're like, I think I could nut before my phone dies. Like, it just becomes an exciting game.
You wonder if that's what he was thinking. You wonder if he was just gotta get it done.
So as a teenager, police officers actually arrested Bundy on two occasions for larceny and grand theft auto, actually. Mm-hmm. But the details of these crimes were removed when he reached adulthood.
One thing about Bundy also is that Bundy is, you know, obviously his killing of women and girls is the most important thing. But Bundy throughout his whole life was a prolific criminal in a whole bunch of different domains. He would steal stuff all the time. When he was like working for the Washington Republican Party, when he was going to school, he would just do stuff like that. He would just steal clothes, steal cars, you break into things. Bundy is not just a killer; he is just a criminal all the time. But people didn't know that because he didn't fit the image.
And Anne Marie Burr, an 8-year-old girl, vanished inexplicably from Bundy's neighborhoods. Obviously, this is something he denied, but when he was eventually incarcerated, the FBI felt that he remained the prime suspect in that disappearance.
He also, in his final interviews and before he's executed in Florida, Bundy refused to talk about any of the child murders. He was, I don't think, ashamed of them necessarily, but he didn't like being associated with child murderers. He thought himself better than that. But he was asked about that, and he had the same response that he had to the other two girls that we know he killed, including his last victim, Kimberly Leach. The same response about this first girl to those, like, I'm not talking about that. So I think there's, I mean, who else is killing girls in the neighborhood? You have the budding psychopathic murderer. I think that it's very likely he did. And in America, he kills, I think, at the age of 15. That's very early. But we previously had Peter Curtin from Germany, who killed two boys at the age of 9. So it does happen that you have people kill as children or as teenagers. That does happen. So, and the thing is also that we talk about the different things that serial killers do in ramping up to killing. And, you know, in the past, we talked about, like, some of them set fires, animal cruelty. One thing Ted Bundy did that I think is very revealing about who he was as a person is that when he was a kid, he would buy entire colonies of mice from the pet store. And then he'd line them up in order and pick one mouse to spare and kill the others. In his mind, that was just showing that he was a god, but a merciful god, because he picked one mouse to spare. And yeah, he killed the others, but it showed how, you know, he has this merciful side too, but he's a god. He sees himself as a god, and he's using these mice. And to me, that's what he does with women later and girls, is he's just a god and he makes them his mice.
So it was also that this period when Bunny realized that he was illegitimate. He recalls reacting to it as feeling like he was a bastard. His relationship with Johnny, and now that he realized that Johnny wasn't his biological father, really worsened at the time.
He didn't like him that much because he wasn't as big a much a man as his grandfather, but at the same time, he also really had this image of himself as being like, he wanted to be like these blue bloods. And you can't do that in his mind, certainly probably in reality. If you are a bastard, that does make you a social disreputable at the time, especially. And his image of himself, that really would have hurt it. You know, he has this egotistical, like, this grandiose sense of himself, but and this would have not fit that image. Instead, it's like he's like all the other people who aren't good enough.
I think that when it comes to the true psychopathic and the godlike figure that he becomes, there are two stories that I think blow people away. One where he saved the life of a child and got the commendation from the Seattle PD, but then also that he worked at the suicide prevention hotline. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I think in both those cases, there's such a I control who lives or dies. God, I'm the decider type of environment.
Exactly, so
that is
exactly
very
so
appealing to the Ted Bundy narcissistic psychopathic side to him.
There are so many guys like this who are just like this. There's this guy, a different guy, who said, another killer, who said that when asked, why, if you killed all these people, why did you then do these other nice things for people? He said, I get to choose when I'm good and when I'm bad.
Yeah, sounds like my friend Sean McCarthy.
By the way, Sean is going to appear as a guest on a future episode, I think.
Oh, nice, good. Let him know what I said about
him. He's awesome. But he's a funny guy, too.
Yeah, so in 1965, Bundy graduated from high school and enrolled at the University of Puget Sound. However, he initially failed to declare a major. With 5 children to support, Louise and Johnny could not afford to put Bundy through university. Although he could continue to live with his parents, he did have to work some menial jobs to, like, keep himself afloat at the university.
This was at a time when he hadn't really quite figured out his presentation to the world yet. He hadn't figured out who he wanted Ted Bundy to come off as. And in some ways, this is a little bit like a lot of guys are early on in college, just, or even throughout college, or maybe instead of college, is that they're just kind of like, you know, just sort of goofing off and not really sure of what or why they're there. And, you know, and he hadn't figured out how, like a lot of psychopaths, hadn't figured out how to come off to people the way he wanted to come off, because he doesn't have that instinct to want to be someone's friend. He doesn't have the instinct to just to relate to other human beings as a human being.
Yeah, so he was feeling like lonely and isolated, and feeling inadequate because he couldn't really afford to be at the university. He didn't want to really join a fraternity because he didn't really know how to express himself in that kind of environment. He liked Chinese. He started doing Chinese classes and like discussing international affairs in the Orient. And he thought that was like a sophisticated thing to do. And that's why he really got involved with that. And I suppose this period, he's really thinking about forming himself and his idea of himself.
Hey, Toby, sorry to dog you. By the way, it's Puget. I'm losing Washington cred.
Too, yeah.
The moment you said Puget, I was like, I got to correct Toby on this.
Puget.
You're all good. Puget. Yeah. Yeah,
what kind of university is that? It's not regular. It's not regular.
Oh no, these are all the words of the people that we stole their land from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. These are all native. That's the thing about Washington. Just real quick, sorry to kind of interrupt.
Didn't they get money for that? But, why do we have to pronounce everything?
Casinos, right?
Yeah.
I mean, sure. The thing is that like on the East Coast, ain't nothing named after the people that used to live here, but. You know, Seattle, Puget Sound, Tacoma, like all these are the names that the natives tribes gave those areas. I mean, not all of them, but, you know, Chief Seattle, like these are all the names that the natives chose. So you feel that thing that Simeon was mentioning, I don't know if it was off mic or not, where you just feel like there's death surrounding me right now. And Washington State has a bit of that.
There are actually some in New England. We have some stuff named after the Indians, but we all just like we do the English. But one thing about Puget Sound, little note, it's a body of water, not the university. The university's on it, but it's a body of water full of really large octopus. And it's just a little side note. It's got some of the world's biggest octopus live in Puget Sound. But the university, it's a legit university, but it's not. It's like a secondary state university. It's not fancy. Like, he wanted to be fancy and he wanted to be seen as like someone who could be brought to the dean's office and not for punishment, but as a guest.
Yeah. The University of Puget Sound is not, it's not a commuter school, but it's kind of a commuter school. Is that a term that's known, a commuter school?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I just want to make it clear. Cause it's like, it's not that it's a bad university, but it's one where you drive in and drive out, whereas a proper college academia is built on like a Greek life and a reputable program in medicine and various other fields. But mostly it's got notoriety. You know, Harvard is the place, you know what I mean? MIT, these institutions. There's colleges that teach the same subjects that are equally good, but if you don't have that name brand notoriety, you can't be the blue blood that Simeon has been talking about.
And that's who Ted Bundy wanted to have notoriety. That's what he wanted. And I think what he wanted out of school was to get that notoriety and not necessarily to get the education because to get the notoriety. And in I think that Netflix documentary, I mentioned that he said that it was described, one of the people commenting said that it didn't have the mahogany and tweed he wanted to be associated with. He wanted to be like the guy that people thought was better than them at the university, not the guy who goes to the commuter school, even if he could get a good education reading the right books, not what he was looking for. He wanted to have notoriety.
Yeah, and this leads, because he transfers from the University of Puget Sound to the University of Washington, which does have more of the prestige in the Pacific Northwest that he desired.
Was this where you where he meets this the girlfriend that eventually, according to popular accounts, breaks his heart? But this is not really what happened. But this is where he meets the woman known as Stephanie Brooks.
Yes, Diane Edwards, aka Stephanie Brooks, is met at University of Washington, and from the alleged reports that they believe that she had money, class, and influence. Yep. And all right, so this is where I want to speak. I grew up in Washington. My brother went to UW. I wanted to go to UW, but got rejected. I, instead of going to proper college, started going to community college and started doing comedy at the same time and was performing stand-up and then going to the restaurants where the kids of UW that beat me to get into the school I wanted to go to were getting drunk and eating burritos at a place like Memo's, which was a 24-hour Mexican joint. And I'm looking at these fucking people, and I'm like, the school said you guys are better than me. So
must have made you funnier, though. That must have made you funnier.
Oh, you damn right it did. I felt the rage of what it means to not be in that crowd. I felt the true fire of they're in and I'm out, and I'm going to make them realize that they fucked up. And when it comes to Ted Bundy and this woman, Diane Edwards, aka Stephanie Brooks, I've known plenty of Dianes in my life. And I know how hard these women have broken a motherfucking man. They've turned good men into shallow husks of themselves by the level of vitriol and just cut. Scalpels don't cut nearly as much as a woman that's well off and studies at the University of Washington. A quick sidebar.
Oh, my God.
You guys remember the Amanda Knox situation, murder in Italy? I remember the moment when I went, this case is open and shut. And it's when the first Italian detectives were, like, being, you know, misogynistically, not to be a stereotype, but Italian. And they're like, this dumb fucking white woman is fucking the person. Fuck her. Let's fuck this shit up. And Amanda Knox was like, I'm a white woman from Seattle. Fuck you and your sexist attitudes. I'm going to beat the shit out of you. Even if I did this crime, you will never presume a woman could act this way. And I was like, this is an open and shut case. You've got Seattle white woman feminist ideology up against Italian misogyny. Those are two rams that'll battle to the end of fucking time.
I just want to say, no 19-year-old is better than anyone. So, I mean.
Well, you know, the other interesting things about this is that you can imagine a normal person, which Ted Bundy was not, but a normal guy, absolutely getting their heart ripped out by a woman like this and not being good enough and all these things. But the weird thing about this story is that Ted Bundy is not like most guys. And I don't actually think, I mean, he was violent. He was a murderer before this happened. This may have had some relation to his spree of killings, but he is not like he waited around at home after or threw himself or did whatever else after this, after his heart was broken by this woman. The funny thing is that he initially becomes her boyfriend. She initially buys his act. It's just he can't keep it up initially. But the funny thing is if he had been a normal guy, you could sympathize with that. This rich girl dumped him, and then he gets himself sorted out and becomes the guy that she thought he should have been, and then breaks her heart. You could sympathize with that had he not then gone on to kill 30 to maybe over 100 women. I think if you were a normal guy, then you could sympathize.
I don't disagree with that sentiment. To me, from the research I did, what I came across was what I would argue, and look, this is personal for me. So I'm a Scorpio. I've been wronged in Washington. You know, like I'm not trying to say he ain't a monster, but I felt that Diane broke up with them and she said in more words or less, you ain't shit, you ain't never gonna be shit, and I'll see you in the gutter on my way up. And Ted Bundy
said, I guarantee you she did say that, actually. I can almost guarantee you she did.
I bet Ted Bundy went, okay, we'll see about that. And a lot of people say that this first girlfriend's really lucky he didn't kill her. Everything he does after this is to show Diane, guess what? I'm going to be bigger than you, and you will be a footnote in my legacy, not the other way around. That is how I feel.
Yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, in psychology, there is a term when they look at killers, like when their murders start to happen, start to really explode, called a stressor. And sometimes that means you lose your job. Sometimes your wife or girlfriend leaves you. Sometimes something else happens that disrupts your sort of equilibrium, and then you go on this spree. And it could be that this happening disrupted his equilibrium and he goes on a spree. But I think what it was that I think that he thought that he can just go on in and she would like him as he was. And she didn't, because she was above him in class, and that bothered him. And as I said, normally, it's totally cool to have your own response to it. I think that normally you would. I think in this guy's case, though, I think to some degree that he was trying to do that, but also I think to some degree that this is also about him just, I can get, like when he bought the mice and spared one and killed the others.
Right.
Like,
right.
I think these girls that he gets for him at this time, oddly enough, are like the mice. Because you would think normally these are girls. These are not like hookers or they're white college girls. They're girls that from the moment they started going missing, their disappearance was noted. It was a big deal. But no one thought a guy like Ted Bundy was doing it. No one knew how to track people. As we'll get into at some point, I'm sure throughout this episode,
yeah,
states did not communicate with each other back then. Ted Bundy's driving all over the place, kidnapping girls and depositing their bodies, usually in Washington, but he's mobile in a way that this had never happened. Another thing about this time period is you have the highway system is built, and that transforms America. You have all these people moving around and driving around, and yet the cops are only looking at their neighborhood. They're not communicating with cops in other states. They don't know how to deal with a guy like this, either looking like this and acting like this, or going killing from state to state. Because people think at that time, they thought, well, murders happened because someone didn't like their wife, or someone robbed the local store, or, you know, and if there was anything more than that, they're crazy, or they're gay and we don't care. And this is they didn't know how to investigate this. But I think to some degree this is about that girlfriend. But I also think that he was a murderer before that, and he was by nature in some ways this. And so this is like the thing that happens that kicks it off. But something else I think would have happened if it hadn't been for this. Not to say that the rich girls are not like this to other guys all the time.
And I think this is sympathizing, very heavy on the simp element of the sympathizing.
Look, all I'm saying is that I completely agree that there were various other variables in Ted Bundy's life that may have led him to the life that he ends up living. I there's no doubt in my mind. But fellas, hear me out here for a moment. What did Diane do? You guys ever look at this story and think about that? You guys ever think about that she's just alive during the rest of these murders? And there's never a moment where she's like, you know what? Maybe I should tell some people how I ended things. There's never a bringing up of, oh, by the way, this is what happened when they broke up. And you wonder why. Like, put yourselves in that scenario. If you were dating someone and you're like, you know what, girl, I ain't into this, you know, kick rocks, I think we're done, peace out, right? And that woman ends up going on a murderous spree. You don't think, a cop's up your ass going, what the fuck did you do to that woman?
The thing is, they weren't, though, because they thought that the only people that did that were, like, hobos and black people. I won't say the word.
Yep, you know, you're right. They would say.
Yeah. Or poor people. They weren't. They would not think that that the type of person that we think is respectable would do that. And I think in Diane's case, she probably just thought, oh, this guy was not who I thought he was. I dump it and move on to the next thing. I bet you she didn't give him a second thought. Because he was not violent towards her, he didn't show the side of him that scared people. He might have showed the side of him that is a disappointment and is not up to being her husband at a society function.
Yeah, I mean, you know, apart from the sort of class element, you know, he didn't see him as assertive or highly motivated and things of that nature. They're very, like, sort of, like, natural things that she didn't find attractive in him, but there wasn't, as Simeon said, it was like, it wasn't like he was violent or dominating in any way or anything.
Think about how there's never been someone like Ted Bundy before, in the popular imagination at least. There are plenty of people like Ted Bundy, but they don't look and act like that. But what's funny is that the world we grew up in, the handsome, well put together guy at the bar who sweet talks you, we think, oh, that guy might spike the girl's drink. He might be a bad guy. But back then, they were thinking, no. They're all weirdos. You know that there was never a guy like this before, at least ever seen.
Yeah, it is a anomaly at that time. And you know, from the distance between Olympia and Seattle, where the first few kidnappings and murders occurred, to the second batch that happened in Washington, it's 60 miles. And so when we talk about this lack of communication that Simeon brought up between departments, it's not like, oh, they're across the country. It's like, no, they're an hour away by car. And so it is really a lack of foresight by the departments to not have. But like Simeon said, at this time, the departments didn't feel the need to talk to each other. And I have not done nearly enough research on this recently, but from my research on police in general, it's not the same now necessarily, but it's not like departments are constantly communicating with each other left and right. Like, if they got a question, they're asked, but it's not like our authorities in the United States are coordinated in their attack for protecting and serving. I mean, there's memos that come from above, but it ain't Twitter between the police departments.
Right, but if you look at a lot of killers from this time, you'd have one person call in and say, hey, my son or daughter or whoever else is missing, and they would not even look. And in some cases, like, you know, you didn't have the Amber Alert system yet. That happens after right. Gacy. We'll get to that. There wasn't anything done, except in this case, that's not really true, because the moment these girls start disappearing, people do notice, because they are, you know, they're not the lowest class of, but they no one had any idea. They're just disappearing. When this starts to happen, it's not that they've been taken by who, it's they're gone. What happened
to them? Yeah.
And also, lots of people saw Ted Bundy's car in the area, but they're just like, it's just some guy in his car. You know, maybe he goes to the college. Maybe he's the dean's son. They're not thinking this is the guy who has a woman in his trunk who he's driving out to the woods to rape and kill. That's, and then leave her body there. They're not thinking that. But the thing is, at this time in general, with a different class of people generally, then, you know, people, they didn't investigate. You know, we did Dean Cora, which is mostly poor redneck kids were being killed. They didn't investigate at all. They sued the parents for hiring a private investigator. They sued them what is it? This is our business, but they weren't investigating. Now these people, this was an investigation. These girls, but they were there and they weren't.
Yes, so the girls were like 18 to 25, as Simeon describes. Most of them weren't hitchhiking, but a couple of them were. A couple of them were actually 12 years old. So there were some younger girls who were killed. The approach was stalking, faking an injury or disability, using crutches or a cast, impersonating a figure of authority, carried handcuffs, a crowbar, knife, duct tape, gloves, rope, and other tools. Actually, more tools outside of the place that he killed them than a lot of the killers actually we've covered. I think the paraphernalia of the serial killer that you might watch on TV, a lot of this stuff kind of comes from Bundy.
One of the reasons they say that this guy is such, like, he was at the time, I think, called the genius of death or some ridiculous nickname like that, and he's not, but he did pioneer some techniques used by killers that the police did not know how to handle simply because they'd never seen it before.
Yeah, from what I understand, within the first, I think, 6 to 8 victims, he pulls a scheme at Lake Sammamish. He's in a arm cast, and he'll approach a woman and walk to his VW Beetle and then come back like 40 minutes later and run the same thing again. And he does this with 2 of his victims that would end up dying. But from that, people do see this going on and report it, because at this point they figure out that he is white, he uses a arm sling, and he's got a V-dub. But the problem was that when they put that out of an APB of a individual named Ted that's got a V-dub Beetle and is killing people, they got 3,500 calls.
That was a really common car at the time, everybody.
But also 3,500 people were suspected of being a murderer to some people, basically. Like, that's such a large amount of people that are like, you know what? I know a guy. This dude's kind of creepy. He might be killing people. Like, that's what happened.
Yeah, we get that all the time on this podcast, actually. People are calling out the creepy guy in their house, or their father that they don't like, or something like that. You know, it's always the same.
The thing is, though, is that the fact that he used his name, which was Ted, that's not a lot, but it was the first real piece of information that they had to narrow down. I don't think if he doesn't say, my name's Ted, if he says, my name's Steve, they never catch him, or they need another similar break to catch him. Because they had nothing before that, nothing. Before the Lake Sammamish Day, that was an event where there were like thousands of people at a park in... And you know, at a lake in Washington State, and Ted Bundy kills 2 young women who are having a nice beach day, then, and is seen talking to all these other women. But that might have said, well, this guy's white. But the thing is, and he fits in. But just the fact that he said his name is not a lot, but it's something. It's a place you can start. And they had no idea before that day.
There was some killings that aren't confirmed that happened before the Karen Sparks Karen Sparks attack in 1974. Which killings were those?
Well, he was suspected to have murdered an 8-year-old girl in his neighborhood when he was 15. But the one when he was 15 is, I think, the first one he is suspected of. But it's more what I was thinking of is that listed as having killed 30 women, maybe more. But he suspected, and he told one of his lawyers this, that he may have killed over 100. So he suspected in a lot of murders, some of which he confessed to and some of which he didn't, because I think he was trying to control his image. But the one is, was it the ones, I think, before he as he would later do in Florida, he breaks into 2 women's houses and like bludgeons them, and they're found in their beds, I think. But yes. But in terms of the ones before that, it was mainly the one when he was 15. But it's in the just general time range. He kills women in all manner of different states, and there are many that he's suspected of that we don't know who killed them or where, if they're in some cases, where it happened to them.
Oh yeah, so this is Lonnie Turnbull and Lisa Wick in June of the 24th, 1966. These were Florida State University students who he's suspected of having killed. But the Karen Sparks assault is thought of as the first confirmed assault. So this is on the evening of January the 4th, 1974. Karen went to bed in her basement bedroom in the apartment she shared with three male roommates. Bundy broke into the bedroom using a metal rod. He bludgeoned her almost to death. Bundy then sexually assaulted Karen with a metal speculum, causing her massive internal injuries. Mm-hmm. She suffered permanent brain damage from the attack, but did not die. The next victim was Linda Ann Healy. Linda was out at a bar with her friend and roommate, Karen, on the evening of January the 31st, 1974. The pair returned to their apartment and went to bed, but on the morning of February the 1st, Karen was woken by the sound of Linda's alarm clock. Karen went into Linda's room, found it empty with the bed made.
Well, I think this is around the time they start to think maybe that what's going on, because she was expected to work and she didn't show up to work.
And Linda was, you know, she fit the profile. She, you know, she was born in 1952. She was considered to be beautiful. People perceived her as potentially, because she could have been a model. She had long urban hair, sparkly blue eyes. She was an upper middle class university student majoring in psychology. She was working with children with disabilities and considered by members of the community as being very friendly and helpful. So yeah, these were the kinds of women that he was looking to attack. The detective found bloodstains in Linda's bed and a bloody nightgown in the closet. I realized she had been assaulted and abducted. Linda was never found.
Oh, it is worth noting that Bundy's victims in general fit some version of this profile, that someone who is middle to upper middle class. Most of his victims were considered very attractive. They had prospects. Some of them were married, were newly married. Most of them were not married, but they were the kind of the types of girls that whose disappearance would be unbelievably important. And
1974 is almost like a reign of terror. So the first attack happens January, February, Linda Ann, March, Donna Gail Manson. Manson disappeared after planning to attend a concert at Evergreen State College. Manson was reportedly depressed at the time of her disappearance. Her parents is a sociable person. It's likely Donna the ploy that was used on Donna was used many times. Bundy was working a part-time job at the time. He was able to use plaster casts. He had his Volkswagen Beetle. She used to drag Donna into the car. When police received the report that Donna was missing, they classified her as high risk. Donna regularly skipped class and often stayed at friends' houses, so police didn't immediately take her abduction seriously. In fact, to the beginning, the police, as Simeon has said, never linked Donna's disappearance to the murders of Linda and to the attempted murder of Karen. In August 1978, two fishermen found a human skull, bones, hair, and a multicolored shirt in the foothills of Mount Rainier. Bunny said he dumped Donna's body.
Are you going to chastise Toby for pronunciation of Mount Rainier, or should I?
God damn it. It's fucking Americans, man.
That's the biggest
thing. You make up places and you expect people from places to pronounce them.
For a American whose parents are Indian to criticize a British person, regardless of their race, it's kind of nice. It's kind of nice to say.
Yeah, didn't we just give you one with the PM?
Kind of nice. Kind of nice to just be like, oh. Hey, by the way, you across the pond, fuck. You ain't saying our words correctly. Yeah, sorry. You got to respect the people.
Well, this is when I become the representative of the British Empire.
Well, Mount Rainier is the biggest mountain in Washington State, and it's I don't think it was ever yours, but I don't know.
That's true. That's a good point.
So in April, it's Susan Elaine Rancourt. Susan was abducted from the campus of Central Washington State on her way to meet friends. Her skull was later found on Taylor Mountain. Bundy confessed to her murder shortly before his execution. Even more disturbingly, is publicity around Susan's disappearance intensified. Two other female students reported being approached by a strange man on campus. The man, the woman said, had his arm in a sling and asked them to help him to carry his books to his car, which was a tan-colored Volkswagen Beetle.
There's another thing about Ted Bundy that is, I think, one of the reasons he's still so scary. I think he's scared people, you know, in the recent documentary from a few years ago. He still scares people because he takes advantage of the way women are raised to, and they're in, and some of their natural instinct, you might say, to just be helpful and be kind of maternal. And if someone approaches them in a sling, even if they're a man, you know, they're going to help. A lot of times, not all. Mm-hmm. Not sometimes they might have something that says, "No, I don't want to do that. This guy's scary or whatever. Maybe some other reason." But they're going to. This guy took advantage of their kind of their the way they were raised and their either you could say maybe their natural instincts to be helpful and use that to lure them to win where he could then club them and kill them and so. He was just trying to pretending to be kind of like a wounded child, and they just said, I want to help this person, and suddenly that's all a ruse, and he can kill them.
Yeah. So Caitlin and Susan were a little bit like wary of him because he did seem a bit disheveled at the time. Jane Curtis reported a similar incident occurring 3 days earlier. Only this time, Bundy had opened his car door and ordered her to get in. Jane refused and ran away, but didn't report this incident until weeks after Susan had disappeared. Police never retrieved Susan's body. Like the other three girls attacked before Susan in 1974, she wore her hair long and straight and parted in the middle.
Yeah, you know, just to really quickly, at University of Washington, where he studied but dropped out to be a lawyer, he did take psychology classes and, like we mentioned, had a commendation from the Seattle PD for his work. So he, you know, the entire time he's committing these abductions and murders, he also has girlfriends. He's also playing the game of living a semi-regular life in the beginning here. And what's very odd is that you think you'd be one-track minded as a serial killer, but he's really understanding the way to get away with such heinous crimes is to appear normal. And that's the thing that I think shocks the nation, is that he's not a lone nut that is crazy. He's a regular person.
Yeah, because like Kemper had killed someone before and people knew about it and he'd been institutionalized. Dick Harrell was a little weird. Dick Harrell was a little weird. Like he hung around with just kids, which is a little strange. But like Bundy, at least as he gets older and probably as he becomes more comfortable within himself, like he attended the Republican National Convention in 1968 and stumped for Rockefeller. Yeah, me and Yogi know a bit about that.
That's right. Oh yeah.
And he started working for Art Fletcher, city council member, pursuing the Republican nomination for lieutenant governor, progressed as a volunteer to from a professional volunteer to a professional activist. He worked in for the Washington State Republican Party. So he's growing ever more sure of himself. Obviously, Bundy graduated university in Washington in 1972. He worked for the Washington governor Daniel Evans' re-election campaign. He actually like came up with a really smart idea of shadowing Evans's opponent, former governor Albert Rosellini, and recorded his stump speeches for analysis for the Evans team. So he seemed to be like actually pretty good at politics as well.
Psychopaths are really good at politics. They just are. And one thing also, by the way, just so people know, he got a degree in psychology. This guy, he really did know how to use, and he used it, and he used And when he was in politics, I think he started to feel like I'm with my people now, because he was in an environment full of other people who had no conscience, who were self-promoters, who lied all the time. So suddenly, you know, suddenly he's in with a bunch of other people who, I think he said basically that, you know, a real American is invisible. They just create an image of themselves, and that in politics, everyone is classy and promotes an image and tells people how to feel about them. And he hit right in. By the time he gets into politics, suddenly he's around people, not maybe some people like him, but also people who appreciate someone who is willing to just do what other people aren't willing to do, who has these qualities that fit right, pretty right in with politics.
Yeah, his actions actually feel very 1972. It feels like the Nixon-McGovern thing where the plumbers would do almost anything. They'd steal speeches. They'd make fake speeches. They'd plant things on people. Like he would have fit right into that, you know, Nixon set at the time. Like Dean, who worked for Nixon, there's always that talk about Dean, you know, wearing wingtip shoes, being very, very cool, very well put together, and being someone who would do anything for Nixon to serve his own career. So yeah, it did seem like this kind of career was potentially emerging for him.
Some people thought he was on track of one day be the governor himself. Seen initially by some people.
Evan Davis thought well of Bundy and described him as smart, aggressive, and a believer in the system. Bundy was accepted into law school at the University of Utah, supported by Washington State lecturers and politicians who wrote letters for him, despite his grade point average kind of being a little bit modest. He got into law school.
Yeah, one of the letters written by a psychology professor at University of Washington about Bundy said, "I regret Mr. Bundy's decision to pursue a career in law rather than to continue his profession training in psychology. Our loss is your gain."
Wow.
So, I mean, like, you know, the man, for as much as you can fault him for being the criminal he is, I think that he's the most cunning criminal of his day and age, which is what scares middle America, because they've never seen a villain of a killer that's intelligent. Typically at this time, you know, I don't want to use such a crass example, but like you think of like, you know, the Looney Tunes villains, the like, you know, the Muggsy, like the mob villains, they're dopes. They might be running, you know, business schemes, but it's not like they understand how human psychology, which in the 1970s is only a subject that has been around for 3-4 decades at that point.
Yeah.
So, you know, they look at psychology then the way we look at AI today, possibly, where it's this is the fucking future, bro. And the fact that Bundy is such a, I mean, just seems like the boy knows how to read and figures out how people act under pressure, because his entire life with his upbringing being in a relatively abusive childhood to then committing crimes and possibly murder at a young age and getting away with it, and instead of internalizing it and feeling guilt and shame, understanding that if he just continues to live and nobody notices, he can keep doing these things. I mean, it must have been such a enticing time for Ted Bundy, because he could get away with so much.
Edmund Kemper, who we covered earlier, is a borderline genius, but Edmund Kemper was antisocial. He was kind of a nerd. He was 6 foot, 6'9". He was not a guy who could fit in, and he didn't know how to talk to women at all. So the thing is that he actually knew a lot about psychology too, but he couldn't use it. This guy could use the ability. He was smart, not a genius. He could use the ability in these environments because he could fit in. And one of these you see in the documentaries about him, even like, I think the one on Netflix, some people said they thought that it was too complimentary. I think what they got is how positively this guy was seen. Like, women thought he was trustworthy. They thought he was nice looking, though they didn't necessarily, it wasn't like Zac Efron or like that. But Ben thought this guy is like, they thought, well, if only I was this suave and cool and good looking and able to ingratiate, you know. So I think he had a combination of intelligence, education through his own efforts, and that he had the social ability and that he was seen as the boy next door. Because there are some, there are actually a handful of serial killers who are genuine geniuses, but pretty much all of them are either really weird or there's something about them that's different, or they just sabotage themselves. And Bundy does too. But it, one thing also, this little note, 1974 is when a lot of this starts. It's when John Wayne Gacy starts killing people, when BTK starts killing people. It's kind of when a lot, I think in many ways, when we think of the 70s as a violent time, as a, you know, Vietnam has just ended, Watergate has just happened. It's sort of like America's about to lose its innocence. And a lot of killers start killing, but only Ted Bundy is the boy next door. The other guys are not. Or in the case of BTK, no one knew who it was at the time.
Right.
Yeah, so at the time as well, he dated Liz Kendall and Stephanie Brooks at the same time. So he's able to maintain these quite, like, for someone who had such difficulty in his adolescence fitting in, he's able to maintain two romantic relationships with their own dynamics at the same time. So yeah, he's becoming a quite sophisticated person while also committing these murders.
He totally sweeps Liz Kendall off her feet. And I think she's a single mother and who is in the Mormon church. So it's a little different than maybe Stephanie Brooks, but she's, but he totally sweeps her off her feet. And her daughter for a time, it looked up to him, and he's got game at this point. He's really got game. There's no doubt about that.
The man loves to fuck. He's a Scorpio. What can I say?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think what he really loved was he loved to control and to manipulate and maybe also, because the thing is one time when he was involved is that in general, like, if you look at most of his crimes, he raped a lot of women after he killed them, or he talks in that Netflix documentary, he talks about sex as, well, it was just what you do, you know, with your possessions, something that are the ones that are women, or you, it was what you do at the end of, after you've committed your what you really want to do, which is to control people utterly. And I think that the sex was almost like that's the coup de grace. But he was really good at getting women into bed when he put in the effort.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now he moves to Utah. And on his way to Utah, actually, he tells Liz Kendall that he loves her. While on his way to Utah, he also saw a young girl hitchhiking, and he killed her. So he's managing to balance these. Can you guys hear the fireworks in the background, by the way?
I can.
Barely, yeah.
Okay, let me just, I don't know what day this is, but yeah, the British, man, they're always celebrating some historical thing, isn't it?
Oh, I wonder why.
That was a win.
Looks like we've won again.
He's off to Utah.
Guy Fawkes night. Guys, Guy Fawkes.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
When he heads off to Utah,
the Catholic usurper has been a.
Yes.
When he heads off to Utah, that's to go to law school. But he also was starting to get suspected of murders in Washington at that point, right?
Or that's right. Yes.
Yeah, he was partly suspected of murders in Washington, and in Utah on the evening of the 2nd of October, 19-year-old cheerleader Nancy Wilcox disappeared from Utah on the outskirts of Salt Lake City. By witnesses, she was last seen in a VW Beetle. That's becoming a hallmark of the killings, but also people are spotting the car now.
Yeah, it. One thing I wanted to mention was that, so like I said earlier, the distance between Seattle and Olympia is 60 miles. The distance from Seattle to Salt Lake City is 1,300 kilometers. So to put that in perspective, that's the distance between Paris and Bratislava for our European listeners. But the reason I bring that up is because later on, he talks about people he killed in Oregon and Idaho, and the direct route between Seattle and Salt Lake City, which is a little over 600 miles, cuts through pieces of both of those states. I mean,
yeah.
You know, he was on the road. You know, I've driven through those states. I've done road work in that part of the world, and you're in the middle of fucking nowhere. Like, it is wild today how just if you were to go on a road trip with someone and you happen to murder them in the middle of there, unless they had family that knew about it, you could get away with it because it's just, there's nothing out there. And you notice that he didn't have any Montana state victims, because Montana women don't play these games, you know what I mean? Montana women don't care how charming you are. If you can't cut wood, they ain't trying to fuck at all. And Bundy's like a scraggly intellectual at this point. You know, he's picking up women in Washington and Salt Lake City and Idaho and East Oregon, but Montana women would not play none of that shit.
What's funny though is Liz Kendall's daughter, really just a little kid's thing. His daughter, you know, at the time, said that she thought he was athletic. He would run and jump and throw the balls with him. But the little kid's perspective was, you know, they didn't know who he really was at the time. It's interesting. There's an anecdote by someone I saw who was with, I think, a friend. It was a girl, woman, I think. It was their friend. It might have been a girl, another female friend or boyfriend, who was hiking in the woods in Utah at the time, or I think maybe near one of those borders area on some sort of camping trip. And she said that she ran into someone who was burying a body at the time, and later found out it was Ted Bundy, that, you know, after seeing the picture. So he would, I think he was killed. He's suspected of murders in like California and all manner of other states. He probably killed a whole lot more than he is ever given credit for, but we don't know, because a lot of people went missing and states didn't communicate and everything. But no, he easily could have done that, and he doesn't like plan every single one out. Sometimes he just uses his tricks, or just to lure someone. But he could have killed a number of them on a trip from Washington to Utah, easy.
A 21-year-old student Rhonda Stapley was traveling back to the campus of the University of Utah after a dental appointment when a tan Volkswagen pulled up at the bus stop. She described the cute driver leaned over, rolled down the passenger window, and asked where she was going. He told her to hop in. The possibility that this man could be dangerous did not enter my mind, she said. He was handsome, clean cut, and I felt certain he was a college student, a friendly student helping out a fellow student. She said she describes never dreamed of hitchhiking. In the car, she told him her name was Rhonda and she was studying pharmacy. He introduced himself as Ted and said he was a first year law student. She soon noticed that he did not follow the regular route back to the campus, but he said he had an errand to run near the zoo. Ted looked like a typical university student, she said. He had slightly curly dark brown hair, a nice complexion, and his smile was friendly and inviting. He wore dark slacks and a green pullover sweater, not unlike what I would expect to see on a law student on his way to and from class. He was polite, he didn't talk much, but when he did, his voice was confident, his conversation articulate and on subject. Well, when they got to the zoo, he drove straight past it and continued up Immigration Canyon. It was obvious he had no errand to run, she said, but I was not worried. I just figured he was taking me on a little ride. It felt like sort of flirtatious, she says. At the end of Parley Canyon, he would have turned right, but back towards campus. Instead, he turned left and drove up another deserted canyon. Rhonda began to get nervous. Bundy had stopped talking. He drove silently, gripping the wheel. He made no contribution to the conversation. And even though Rhonda tried to keep it going, he did not nod or respond in any way. He slowed on the corners of the twisting road as if hunting for a picnic spot. I thought that he must be looking for a place to park, she said, and I was uncomfortable with the idea. Her mouth was sore from the dentist. I knew that kissing would only make it worse. Besides, I hardly knew this man. I wasn't really a make-out kind of girl. On the other hand, she did not want to offend the cute law student and tried to think up excuses for not stopping. As the sun sank low in the sky, he found a place that suited him. He pulled off the road into a wooded area where there was a picnic table. Stopping the car, he turned off the engine, turned towards her and leaned in close. I was nervous he was going to kiss me, she said. I didn't want to kiss him, but I didn't know how to get out of the situation without embarrassing myself by making such a fuss. With his face inches from her, he said quietly, do you know what? I'm going to kill you. He put his hand around her throat and started squeezing. Hours passed before she regained consciousness. She found herself sprawled out on the ground, face down in dirt, surprised to be alive. It was now completely dark, with the scene lit only by the interior light of the VW shining out of the open door. Bundy stood there fiddling with something behind the seat. Barely conscious and terrified, Rhonda realized that this was her chance to escape. Pumping adrenaline, she jumped up and ran into the darkness, but her trousers were still around her ankles and she tripped and fell. For a moment, she felt as if she was suspended in midair, then found herself in an ice-cold water. She had fallen into a fast-flowing mountain stream. This carried her away from her attacker, but now she feared she was going to drown. Then she hit a tangle of tree limbs and pulled herself out of the water. Cold and wet, she made her way across the rough terrain, following the course of the river, figuring that Salt Lake City was downstream. She pressed on, constantly worrying about the monster who attacked her, was following her. Rhonda did not think about reporting what had happened to the police. She had Mormon. She was frightened. She feared that she was no longer a virgin as well. And yeah, she didn't tell the police right away about this. But this is kind of like, you know, a sort of longer profile of the kind of thing that Bundy was doing, and a victim that did manage to escape.
One of the few who did, I think. A few others, some others did, but in general, I think that he mostly killed the women he kidnapped. Hello, everyone there?
Oh, sorry, what was it? Hello?
Oh, hi, are you there?
Yeah.
Around this time, Bundy was also masquerading as a police officer.
People. Roselyn, right? Or something like that?
Was it Carol the Roach? Yeah, I think that was the Carol the Roach one when he was masquerading as a police officer.
Yeah, he went into like a mall to...
Yeah, he entered the Sears Mall. The place was full of Christmas shoppers, and he engaged her, claiming to be a police officer. So she was, she said, thought about herself as a law-abiding citizen, and again, predisposed to comply with authority. Bundy always uses like his heuristics, either as like a charming law student or police officer, or, you know, like he's a person in disheveled, but he's a man in distress. He really exploits women's weaknesses with all the things he does.
Yeah, he really does understand with his psychology background, and I think with him having cultivating the appearance that he does, that the heuristics used by women, that he flips of all of them. Sometimes they're protective of women, sometimes they work. But he flips all of them. He makes them all work for his advantage. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why to this day he's still you know, scares people to such an extreme degree. And I, you know, what right there with Gacy and Dahmer, he's right there. And in some ways, for some people, he's more so.
The other thing about this time is that Liz Kendall does contact the police officers because she suspects Bundy, and they tell her that they already looked into him, but they discounted it. Which she
Bundy was weird. Accepted by the Mormons, I think.
What'd you say?
I said Bundy became a Mormon. He was accepted and defended by the Mormon Church. That might have been part of the reason.
Oh yeah, yeah, but Bundy, yeah, he was.
I didn't know that.
When he was dating Liz Kendall, yeah.
So Liz was relieved that Ted was not a suspect. Felt guilty that she suspected him. Her suspicions were further allayed when she discovered that Deborah Kent had been abducted sometime after 10 p.m. Pacific time. That Christmas, Liz returned to Utah to spend the holiday with Bundy and her parents. But her doubts did persist about him.
It's like wild how simple his plan of attack was, but I think that's kind of a part of why it's so effective. You know, it's not flashy. It's not like, you know, come here, I've got a box of candy. You know, it's not sadistic. It's just kind of like, my arm's broke. Could you help me with my car? And then, you know, bonk over the head. And then now you're being trafficked. Like, I think that in terms of capturing a audience or the country's mindset of what's going on, the more simple the story, the more terrifying it feels. And we'll cover this later on with the Florida victims, because those court cases were the first ones to be televised. America got to put a face that moves and talks to this person that they had been reading about. And that just makes everything so real as well.
Yeah, it's simple, so it feels like it could happen to everyone.
Right.
And when we covered Southern Sam, it's similar, you know, people being shot in their cars. Like, so like almost like everyone in New York wanted to stay indoors because they didn't want this to happen to them, even mm-hmm. though it could only happen to very, very few people.
Yeah.
And so around this time, you have some killings in Colorado, and the police don't really have any leads. But then two students from Green River Community College were doing a survey of forests in Taylor Mountains, Washington, and then they discovered one of Bundy's dumping sites. And so that now they are sort of getting a little bit closer. But that by this point, Kent County Police had looked at 2,000 Ted lookalikes and checked out 916 vehicles. They had whistled down the list of possible suspects to 200. Bundy's name remained on the roster, but as a law student, people didn't really suspect them.
I believe that this is right on the cusp of DNA and dental evidence being utilized in court cases, is Ted Bundy himself. I'm kind of jumping around a little bit here, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is, you know, cops and how they operate in the actual functional parts of their jobs really become innovative in the 80s, where they go, you know what, we need to be better than we saw a footprint.
And one of the reasons that happens is because of these cases where you have either victims who are particularly valued in society, or you have, you know, someone who is just like, just someone like Bundy or Gacy is such a part of things that suddenly, you know, it just shakes people that someone like that could be the guy that could be the worst guy they could possibly catch in their career, or the worst guy they possibly have in their neighborhood. And so it becomes necessary. And And I think that, you know, I said when we get to Gacy, we'll get to the invention of the Amber Alert system. There are things like that are put in place in the 1980s and going forward that cut down the number of victims that you see routinely in the 70s, even though the 80s actually is worse for that time period until the early 90s.
With the disappearance of Julie Cunningham and Denise Olveson, Michael Fisher began to see a similar pattern to the one that emerged in Utah with Colorado. So now people are connecting the dots, and he called Detective Jerry Thompson at Salt Lake City Sheriff's Office to compare notes. Now they're starting to talk to each other. They met up, and it became clear that the murders in Utah and Colorado were the work of a single killer. It's interesting for the next murder. Now, Bundy's doing a scattershot work here. Bundy strayed out over the border into Idaho on the Monday of the 5th May, 1975. He drove up in the Portello. He took a room in the Hotel Inn just a mile from Idaho State University, and he started stalking women there as well. He's feeling really anxious about what's happening in Utah and Colorado and the news that's happening. Although he's enjoying it, he wants to spread his killing more broadly now.
Right.
I think one thing is that these guys, they, particularly the narcissists, when they start killing and they start becoming successful, all their plans are working and everything goes according to plan and it keeps working over and over again, They keep expanding and building it. The narcissism feeds itself, and eventually that will destroy them. But in the meantime, they keep increasing their what they're trying to do. They keep adding on to it, and to some degree they can't control it.
Well, it fuels them. You know, it gives them adrenaline. It feels like, and you know, Bundy in this time has what's going on in Colorado and Utah heating up, and he probably could lay low and roll out and never be found. But he, you know, it's like a gambler's addiction. It's like, yeah. I gotta keep it rolling.
It's a compulsion. You just can't stop. So on the night of the 15th of August, 1975, Bundy was driving around Salt Lake County smoking dope. He claimed he was not hunting for a fresh victim, but it was clear he had been watching young women hitchhiking. Around 2:38 a.m. on the 16th of August, he was sitting in his car in a side road in Granger, Utah, when he was suddenly dazzled by the headlights of a patrol car. Bundy panicked and took off at speed, neglecting to turn his headlights on. Sergeant Bob Hayward of the Utah Highway Patrol followed him as he ran to stop signs. He was coincidentally the brother of Captain Pete Hayward, who was heading the homicide investigation in Utah out of Salt Lake City. When Bundy hit the main road, he flicked his lights on, but Sergeant Hayward continued the chase. There had been a series of burglaries in the area, and Sergeant Hayward thought he was pursuing one of the thieves. Unable to take the patrol car, Bundy threw the dope out of the window and pulled into a derelict gas station. Sergeant Hayward is calling for the backup when the driver got out. He had fuzzy shoulder length hair, and he's wearing blue jeans, a black turtleneck sweater, and tennis shoes. Walking to the rear of the car, he smiled and said, "I guess I'm lost." Keeping his hand on his 38, Sergeant Hayward said, "You ran two stop signs." He asked to see Bundy's license and registration information. Bundy got them from his car, and Sergeant Hayward studied them. He asked him what he's doing here. Bundy said that he'd been to see the Towering Inferno at Redwood Drive-In nearby. The cinema was in Hayward's patrol area. Two other troopers came from the highway patrol, pulled up with a sergeant. Their pod sergeant asked if he could look in Bunny's car. Bunny said, "Go ahead." The first thing he noticed was the passenger seat had been removed and lay on its side and on the back seat. Then he noticed a small crowbar lying on the floor behind the driver's seat. The beam from the flashlight played over a brown gym bag. Sergeant arrested Bundy for evading an officer, frisked and handcuffed him, then called the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office, asking them to send a detective, and Brandy was brought into to Cassidy for the first time.
I see some lines too there.
I believe that when they bring him to custody the first time, that it reveals the stash that he had in his vehicle. And one item that I noticed that doesn't exist as much anymore is the ice pick.
Yes.
Ice pick. Not a weapon really utilized today, even as a tool, mostly because ice is not sold in gigantic cube quantities. But also, the ice pick is such a iconic murder weapon that it's not really looked at as an ice pick anymore. You see that ball with that sharp point, and you're just like, oh, that's straight for accidental / premeditated murder in a hotel room. That's all that's
there
for.
There are other killers who are, in some ways, I think, even worse than Bundy. Lawrence Whitaker in California, who was known for killing teenage girls with ice picks. I think you're right that there's just the associations it has. And also because of those killers, if you would get pulled over now and you have that in your car, that's the first thing they're going to think of. They're going to think of Ted Bundy and Lawrence Whitaker and that kind of person. So,
and you know, ice pick manufacturers must have been ripping their hair out of this nonsense.
Not for killing women.
It's a tool that works. What do you mean nobody's buying it? Sorry, boss. It's just not selling as it used to. I'm telling you, you got ice. You need a pick. You get. What are you gonna use? A regular kitchen knife? No, it'll dull it. You need an ice pick. And it's like, boss, these killers, they using your tool. It's just not working out anymore. I don't care what these killers are doing. We need to put more. Money
you know,
in marketing.
Like when I was a teenager, I had a couple like more disgruntled friends than myself, and they were always like, oh, if I killed someone, I'd kill them with an ice pick. And I was like, what? But it was always like, oh, you wouldn't trace it or something. I don't know. It was like,
I wish there were also horror movies that have used.
But in that shop, I suspect that like he might be getting like different clientele now. They're just serial killers, but maybe like the cartel now. I mean, they maybe he'd be able to replace their customer base from.
Oh sure.
Yeah.
Oh
from sure. By
like,
people.
Oh right. Exactly. Like, right. Boss, you're not seeing the giant marketing opportunity we have here. Fuck ice. We could just be selling this to killers. We could go to the mob. We go to the cartel. We could go to the military. Ice picks for everyone. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
So, at this point, he's in custody. He's asked about the tools, and the detective says they look like burglary tools. But, you know, Bundy says, well, they're not. He just says that they're regular people have the things that are in the car. it began to dawn on Detective Thompson the following Monday when he was glancing through the arrest report for the weekend and came across the name Bundy. He had heard that name before and remember the young woman from Seattle who had made inquiries about Ted. The handcuffs found in the car reminded him of the Carol DeRoach attack. His suspicions were reinforced by Detective Ondrak, who brought up Bundy's arrest at a meeting of detectives from the surrounding counties. They thought Bundy was an armed robber, but now they're starting to think that they might have their man.
Sometimes these guys, when they get the information that they need, they put it together. There's before they would not have thought.
And they also found a Wildwood Inn map. Detective Thompson said that that's the place where our girl went missing. Yeah, by this time, you know, Bundy's heavily drinking. He's scared. He's calling Liz Kendall. Her suspicions are going off more because she suspected him before. And witnesses start identifying Bundy and his Volkswagen.
One thing is Bundy frequently drank fairly heavily before committing murders because it got rid of some whatever it made him even more effective, or made the part of him that wanted to kill more uninhibited, and it showed he wanted to, but anyway, but he would drink.
Yogi, do you ever drink before podcasts? I'm a podcast teetotaler, but like Vaughn on my podcast Impressions drinks, and Simon drinks a little bit. I don't like. Do you ever drink, Yogi?
Toby, here's the problem. You see, you and I, we don't have the luxury of having alcohol lower our anxiety to allow us to speak more freely. No, we have to do this thing where if we don't choose our words carefully, we feel like we'll be murdered. And so alcohol doesn't allow us to speak more freely. No, I'm not much of a drinker pre-podcast, but genuinely everyone I've done podcasts with has had a beer or some other alcohol with them. I used to smoke before I edit, but not during the show.
So Simeon, only white podcasters can be in uninhibited on the podcast. Apparently. It's terrible. You see the plight of me and Yogi?
You see us in the fucking dirt, Simeon, having to press the record button, having to learn how to say shit like Puget Sound.
I know, it's not that hard. But, you know, one thing about me is I...
Just imagine how I would have pronounced it if I was actually drunk. Yeah, you know? I mean,
yeah,
exactly. Be glad you got what you got, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we need to feed him to the octopus in Puget Sound.
So just to push this a little bit further on October 2nd, 1975, Bundy was charged with the kidnapping and attempted murder of Carol DeRoach in Murray, Utah. Bail was set at $100,000. Liz was obviously stunned. The Seattle newspaper speculated that Ted, arrested in Utah, was also the Ted who was wanted in Washington. Plenty of people who knew Bundy in Seattle thought that he was innocent. They were happy to actually contribute to his defense fund. Is this when the Mormons come in?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, the thing about it is that they are a close set group of people, and they and if you join, they will, if they believe in you, that if you think you're the real deal, they'll defend you. And they did when Ted joined, they did defend him, and thought he can't possibly be your guy you're looking for, and I can see that, you know, he would have thought that was a great cover, but it was more than that. They did just defend him when initially, at least.
Yeah. So he got out. The police were terrified he'd kill again, so they put him on 24-hour surveillance. In his response, he tailed officers who were following him, noticing their license plates and taking photos. He got some pleasure from giving them this slip on occasions.
Real quick, Toby, I apologize for the interruption, but you are correct that after his first arrest, the LDS Mormon Church tried to defend and get him free. Mind you, in 1978 is when they lifted the ban on black people in Mormonism. So just to let you know their priorities in this era.
Yeah, I've heard some people say there's a woman who wrote this book called Confessions of a Sociopath. He's a Mormon lawyer who said that it's the perfect religion for a psychopath, because everyone in Mormonism, you know, their goal is to be a god, essentially. And that was Bundy's goal. Bundy must have actually thought, hey, this is this place, you know, this is the same goal as I do.
I just want to say that although I am sad about the way they treated Mormons treated black people, I'm happy for Ted, because he was quite beaten down in the beginning of the story. He's come up, and now he has the support of the Mormon Church.
That's right. That's right.
He's coming up. He's coming up, so we can come up.
Mm-hmm. That's right. His loss is our gain.
Absolutely. So by December, he's stalking other girls, and the police are keeping an eye on him. But the police intercept him. And I think he's caught at this time. I'm a little confused.
Is this after his first arrest when he's transferred to Colorado?
Yeah, so he left, I think he was bailed out. He left. Let me check my notes.
I don't know exactly where you are in the story, but I believe in his first arrest, he's arrested somewhere and then gets transferred to Colorado. And then Colorado has him and allows him to work in their, like, library. And that's when he escapes.
They weren't paying attention to him. Like, they were just, like, letting him just in the library. They didn't have anyone watching him. It did not occur to them that he might think, I can safely jump out the window of this building. Because no one, until that happened, they're like, he was in there, you know.
But Toby, is that where you're at?
Yogi said on October the 22nd, 1976, Colorado State filed charges against Bundy for the murder of a woman who was missing from the Wildwood Inn in Aspen and was found murdered 1 month later. In April 1977, Bundy was taken to Colorado. Perhaps sensing that he was about to be made accountable for his crimes, he began to plot his escape.
And people call his escapes, you know, and the mastermind of Ted Bundy. What he used his cunning intellect to figure out when the security guard would take a smoke break, and that if he jumped out the window, he'd probably survive this two-story fall. Like, it's not a genius level move. You know what I mean? Like, there's people in prison right now that are making shit that are genius, but they're not held as the masterminds that Bundy is.
And it's not like the El Chapo thing where people were digging into the prison for weeks. You know, the El Chapo thing was so crazy. Like, when I found out about it, there was always these like cartel songs. I remember I danced to the video of his escape because it was just so amazing. Like, I just
that actually required that level of ingenuity. Whereas Ted Bundy, you know, he didn't have to be a genius to, you know, with these cops not even like paying attention to what he was doing. I mean, you didn't have to bust him out like El Chapo.
Well, and that's what, you know, so the people that report on him, they're like, well, he used his charm and just convinced the people in the police department to allow him to. And it's like, I'm going to say this now. I was going to bring it up later. He ain't that good looking. Okay.
Oh, I'm not going to play.
He's not Zach Galifianakis. He's not that good looking. Like, he, you know, I understand that I look at him with a very different light, but in terms of a guy that's like charming, he ain't George Clooney.
And,
you know,
yeah, to me, he's a guy.
Normal.
Like,
I mean, he's sort of normal.
He's a guy who's be like on a train and the girl would be like, oh, he's good looking. And then her friend would be like, nah, he's not good looking.
He's fucking Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. All right. He ain't that good looking. But you know what? A man that can talk, a man that can look at your eyes passionately, that passed for fucking greatness back in the day.
Also, in the annals, if you compare him to people who ended up being serial killers, he's you know, in general, they're not a particularly photogenic bunch or particularly trustworthy bunch. Even the ones who are photogenic, there's something about them that's like, okay, this guy's scary. And I think there is something that way with Bundy. I think a lot of pictures of Bundy, he looks scary. But that's also someone saying that now. At the time, maybe not.
He went from Chicago, Bundy traveled to Michigan, and then finally he got to Tallahassee, Florida. On January the 15th, 1978, Bundy committed his most well-known and ruthless crime. In the early hours of the morning, Bundy walked to the Omega Sorority house located on 661 West Jefferson, picked up a plank of firewood from the yard, and entered the house. First, Bundy entered the bedroom of 21-year-old Margaret Berman. Bundy strangled Berman with a pair of nylon pantyhose and bludgeoned her repeatedly with his wooden club. None of the other women living in the sorority house heard this attack, and so Bundy was able to move on to his next victim unimpeded. Bundy entered the bedroom of Lisa Levi and bludgeoned her. When medics later arrived on the scene and examined Lisa, they found that Bundy had almost bitten off her nipple and had bitten part of her buttocks. These deep bite marks were later used as evidence to convict him. Both Lisa and Margaret died before reaching the hospital. Bundy was able to remain undetected in the sorority house long enough to attack two more women. Bundy grievously beat Karen Chandler and Kathy Kleiner, inflicting broken jaws and other injuries on the women, who both remarkably survived. Bundy left the sorority house as another sister, Nita Neary, was returning for the night. Nita assumed Bundy was a man who was worked at the sorority as a janitor. She approached her bedroom but stopped in her tracks when Karen emerged from the bedroom, blood and dazed. Bundy left the Omega Sorority house and walked immediately to Dunwood Street, where he entered the apartment of Cheryl Thompson Thomas. As police were receiving their report of the terrible events at the sorority house and first responders rushing to the scene, Bundy was beating Cheryl Thomas almost to death. This time, neighbors heard the beating but were too frightened to accost Bundy and called her phone instead. Hearing the phone ring was enough to scare Bundy. He fled, leaving her badly injured. In the weeks following the murders and assaults, Bundy remained in Tallahassee.
Yeah, the second prison escape, in some ways, was more ingenious because he starves himself to lose all this weight and crawl through an opening that he can only get through because he's super skinny, and that's actually pretty clever. But one of the things that happens with these murders in Florida is this is what a lot of criminology people, or at least crime podcasters, will talk about is the devolution of this, which is that he started out with these kind of killings, like just busting into a place and beating women, but then he moved on to kidnapping and this whole ritual where he did things a certain way when in his own space, and then left the bodies where he could go revisit them and all that stuff. I'm not saying that's better, it's more controlled. This is just like he's totally lost control and he's just busted in and he's smashing up. And this is a bit like, someone who will cover much later, but Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, it's a little bit like that. He's just busting in and like killing and or hitting, busting up whoever he gets to. He's not controlled. He doesn't have a dump site. He doesn't have a ritual. He's just completely, he's like an addict trying to get a six. He's completely just trying to just mess up anyone he comes in contact with, and he's not controlling anything. It's completely frantic.
Yeah, like this is a guy who has a whole thing, a whole shtick, but the sorority one especially feels like he's been holding it in for so long. He hasn't got his fix for so long. He's just going insane. Like it really feels like a third act explosion almost.
Yeah, and as I said, he's like someone like Richard Ramirez, who's not someone people normally associate with either the sort of suave some people, sort of a rock star compared to some people, but he was not people thought was a brilliant guy. He didn't have this. He was hyped up on drugs most of the time. Bundy probably was here. He just goes in there and he's just wrecking shop because he has to. You're right. He has to get his fix. He's not being careful at all. He doesn't, not any of the stuff that marked some his peak wave of murders. This is just how many people can he get as quickly as possible with no attention or care paid?
So actually by coincidence, the forensic anthropologist who examined the remains of Jance and Denise Noslund on the hillside near Washington State was in Tallahassee visiting a former student who was then teaching at Florida State University. The Omega murders reminded them of the Ted killings 3 years before when the Seattle ran in the Associated Press reports in the attacks. The similarities were not lost on local journalists either. Bob Campbell phoned the Tallahassee Police Department and gave them a description of Bundy along with his backstory. Criminal investigator Michael Fisher was on an FBI course in Virginia. Deputy District Attorney Milton Blakely, who was heading the case in Colorado, called him, then sent a package on Bundy and his modus operandi to Tallahassee.
This becomes a big part of, I think, why he ends up getting convicted is the bite mark, right?
Yep. Because it's such damning forensic evidence. But also, at these court cases, Bundy chooses to represent himself. And to me, you know, from the piece that I watched, he bungled his own court case. Had he taken the plea deal before it went to trial, he may still be alive to this day.
There's no doubt about that. And actually, some people who were representing him were trying to get him ruled as insane. And he was basically all he did was try to sabotage the efforts of everyone who was dedicated to his case to either get him off or get a sentence reduced or to get him pronounced crazy. He did everything because what he wanted to do was to show that, you know, he could be the successful, well, really not successful, the charismatic lawyer that he never became because he didn't finish law school because he became a serial killer instead. But the thing is that, and this is something you'll see with other guys we cover, you know, once you get to Rodney Alcala, who's a little bit similar to Ted Bundy, who's even more like ridiculous, who uses the song Alice's Restaurant as part of his defense. These guys, narcissistic people, have a, no matter how smart they are, they end up doing incredibly stupid stuff because they can't help their desire to be seen as and worshipped. And that's the case with Bundy. He just wanted people to see who is this charismatic lawyer who, look how smart he is, look how great he is. But he also didn't understand that, okay, well, they're going to also notice that, and when I'm cross-examining this person, I'm reliving the crime. I'm asking about the details of the crime, the gory stuff, and in asking, I'm reliving it over and over again. But he, in his mind, they're seeing is, oh, charming Ted, you know, the all-American boy, and he's a great lawyer, and he's awesome. Yep. They can't, you know, I don't think, I mean, I think if he would have left it up to his lawyers, he probably would still be alive, but he couldn't do that because no matter how smart he is, and he, and there are other people who are higher IQ than him in true crime, but in almost all cases, they have this narcissism that they cannot contain. And even in the case of BTK, we did last time, who wasn't that smart, you know, he also had his narcissism, but he was able to contain it. He was able to contain his issues for a long time until he couldn't anymore. But eventually, it always gets you. Eventually, the narcissistic people always end up getting revealed to be kind of idiots because they can't control it.
Yeah, and, so just before that, he's captured again by Patrolman Lee. The patrolman saw him drunk and the patrol car is rear view. There was he attempted to outrun the cop, but the VW Beetle was crippled. Patrolman Lee drew his revolver as he got out of the car and ordered the driver lay face down on the road. He had got one handcuff closed around the suspect's wrist when Bundy rolled over and struck him in the face. Then he kicked the arresting officer's feet out from under him. Patrolman Lee fired but missed. Bundy ran for it with the officer close behind. Bundy could have escaped, but he kept turning to see if the cop was closing in. Patrolman Lee saw a glint, possibly it came from the handcuffs that were still attached to the suspect, but maybe the gun he fired again. Bundy fell, although he had not been hit. Patrolman Lee approached what she imagined was a dead body. They Bundy kicked out and they had a little bit of a tussle. And instead of firing again, Patrolman Lee clubbed his adversary. Bleeding, Bundy fell to the ground. When he was in the patrol car, he said that he wished the patrolman had killed him, but now he was with the interrogators and finally caught, and there would be no other escapes.
Right.
It's interesting. One thing is that there's a guy who named John Henry Brown, who was one of his former lawyers, who wrote a book about representing Ted. I think he was a lawyer during, I think in Utah there, or in some of the other stuff. He was the first person to find out because Ted called him when he was in Florida before anyone knew he was in Florida. And John Henry Brown, by that point, already knew who Ted was. John Henry Brown said that he thought he was born evil. He is like, he's extremely dangerous. And then he killed over 100 people. Anyway, he said he was prepared to go down and give up his law license and his freedom potentially to kill Ted Bundy if he wasn't arrested. But then thankfully he was, but he knew about that he was there. And the good thing about this case, the only good thing about this case is that Bundy couldn't contain himself. He couldn't not get himself arrested. He could not, you know, put himself in this position. He could not represent himself in court too. And he became out of control by this point.
Yeah. So, Simi, did you have anything on the? I know you've already described the court case well, and the interrogators. Do you have anything else? Or
yeah. I think it's worth noting to talk about when he was when he's you know, convicted and sentenced to death. When he's on death row, he was trying to do these things to buy himself time, and he would confess to various crimes and to buy himself time, and by the time he was executed, they had him pegged officially for 30 murders. It's likely it's many more than that, but one of the things is that throughout the entire procedure before this point, he insists he's innocent. He marries this woman, proposes to marry her, and she accepts it. Well, she's a witness on when he's on trial, because he thought that he'll be less likely to sentence him to death if he had proposed to someone on the stand. It's just ridiculous. But also through this whole time, his mother's been defending his innocence. His mother keeps saying he's innocent. He's just a good boy. And when he finally confesses to try to get more time, his mother was told this, that he had confessed and that he had owned up to it. And she had bought, he was innocent completely. And just like, as I said, the angel in the house, she was told this. And she just, they said, the cops who talked to her said, she squeaked like a little mouse and then said, who wants ice cream? I think that tells you what kind of position she was in her whole life. But the other thing he does is, before he dies, is he arranges this meeting with someone who I have a particular loathing for, I have to say, Dr. James Dobson. I heard his radio show as a kid going to school. And there's a part of me, you know, that takes some level of delight that he became Ted Bundy's last stooge. Bundy just played him like a fiddle. And what he did is Ted Bundy arranged to have this meeting with Dr. James Dobson, this evangelical radio host and minister, so he could then tell everybody that the reason he committed these crimes and the thing that's really responsible for it is not himself, it's pornography. There's no real evidence that Ted Bundy was particularly a reader of pornography necessarily, that he had his own fantasies that I think weren't primarily about sex. They're primarily about power and control and being a god over the mice. But he insisted it was all due to pornography, and that pornography is the reason all violent crimes happened. They're starting to become a problem because of all this stuff. And what he does is he does this because he's trying to maintain control over the narrative, control over how he's viewed, because it didn't work in court, but he's trying to do it there. And he's trying to blame someone or something else for these murders. He's not to blame, it's the porn. And there's very little reason to believe that, but he tries to do that. And in his last moments, his last really years on death row, he's constantly talking to people to try to offload blame on someone else or try to explain it in ways that allow him to control the narrative. He's all about trying to control how he's viewed. That's his whole life is like that. And in his childhood, that's sympathetic, but then later on, not as much. But I think that he probably just gave them a percentage of the number of women he killed. I suspect he probably killed many more, but he used these confessions to extract extra time and extra attention. on his way, you know, but eventually he is executed by the state of Florida. But by that time, he 30 murders for certain, maybe over 100, we don't know. But and he is also examined by Robert Hare, the guy who wrote the psychopathy checklist, which is it's a very blunt tool, but it gives people, it scores people on a 0 to 40 scale from normal, or from utterly not good person, just utterly psychopathic. And Ted Bundy scored a 39 out of 40, maybe one of the highest scores ever on record. It's a blunt tool, but I think this guy is an absolute, you know, the psychopath, an absolute, you know, just sort of narcissistic monster. But he there weren't enough stories he could tell to get himself off death row, because all he could do is keep giving victims and keeping victims, and then he would keep telling people he had more, and eventually all he's able to do is control the narrative of why he did it. Because when he talks to Dr. Dobson, it's only why. He can't give them any more names anymore, because he still wants to hold more information, and because maybe he gave them all the names he knows about. Maybe he doesn't even remember. Maybe he doesn't remember all the women he killed or where.
You know, for me, one of the most damning things by the end, where I don't know if we're at the point where I could talk about his execution. Toby, let me know if that's.
I know, absolutely. Go ahead.
You know, if you watch the news footage of when he's executed, January 24th, 1989, there are people outside of the prison celebrating, lighting fireworks, and championing the execution of Ted Bundy, which I don't disagree with. I've got nothing against that sentiment. But when it comes to the, let's just say, conspiracy side of the Bundy killings, I haven't finished Programmed to Kill. I'm not speaking out of turn. I'm not trying to add any sense of fantasy to this. Ted Bundy was a psychopathic killer. If there is an invisible hand in work with the Bundy situation, the one thing that I see that's an odd correlation is in 1972, let me make sure that's correct, one sec, sorry. In 1973, there's only 14 states where execution is legal. And between 1950 and the 1980, there's not many people being executed in the United States for crimes. That goes up significantly in 82. In 82, only 2 people were killed, but then after that, 1,000 people were to be killed. I think that how the nation feels about corporal punishment, especially with penalty by death, is something that maybe isn't directly influenced by the Bundy situation, but the nation has an egregious example of an individual that should be put to death. And not only are they okay with it, they're fucking celebrating the shit.
And yeah, I mean, yeah.
For something as complicated as the death penalty, if there is an invisible hand involved, a part of me goes, where they may have won, in quotations, is getting the death penalty to be normalized in the United States in this period.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I think the Supreme Court in the 70s actually made the death penalty illegal, and then it was brought back. It's almost like they hit a high watermark of like liberal interventionist government, fiscal government, but also at the Supreme Court level. And then it all sort of fell away, in part because of the crime wave, but also like people like this, like monsters, actually came out and it sort of fixed the American population's mind on, like you say, like some people deserve to be executed, and without any kind of nuance in the conversation anymore. But yeah, people like this definitely brought that out, I think.
It's interesting. Yes, that's absolutely true. I have no disputing this. I think you're 100% correct. There's an interesting example that's sort of similar, which is that in, you know, we think of Texas as the hang 'em high state, you know, they have, they're executing people. In Texas, you see an example of this where there was a, where when Ann Richards was the governor in like the 80s, they had she was blamed because they let out this guy from the Texas prison, Kenneth McDuck, because they had too many people in jail. They couldn't fit them all. And he was a guy who was a bunch of people. And then he would go on to kill a bunch of people. And Ann Richards loses election, and George W. Bush comes in with a hang 'em high promise, although he does pardon one guy, Henry Lee Lucas. And I think that there is some doubt as to whether how many people Henry Lucas actually killed. But the thing is that Ann Richards loses, and that case loses in Texas because this guy got let out. Although it wasn't because of liberal interventionist policies, it was because they were filling the prisons with people who were convicted of drug stuff and traffic violations, and there was just too many people in jail. But they let out the worst possible guy, and then that leads to this. I do think that Ted Bundy and Gacy and some of these other cases, if you want, I think maybe justifiably executed, you might say. Many people think, well, this is a justified policy because these guys need to go. We need to get rid of these guys. But most people who are executed are not that. And some people on death row are innocent. So, you know, and then some people on death row, particularly in the South, are, you know, maybe they committed the crime, but they have an IQ of like 55. They're retarded, or you know, sorry to use the word it is, or you are, they're mentally challenged. They're, sorry, the listeners, anyone has an issue with that, but they're
that was
they're,
that was used scientifically.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right.
But no, you know, there are a lot of people are in prison who I think that would there's a real case to be made. They should not be, but in this guy's case in Gacy, but the other thing about the people celebrating outside is that on one level I don't have an issue with executing these people personally, but throughout history, people have celebrated the executions of people who did not. I think that people will have the party and want to have the party no matter what. So I must say, I don't like to see that.
I have to say the phrase hang him high conjures a party. It's not a grave thing. I think I just think of like George Bush partying and shooting guns in the air while someone's hanged.
And George W. Bush once said that he was certain everyone executed under his leadership in Texas was guilty. Like he couldn't possibly have made a mistake.
Right.
I think that tells you a little bit about the kind of person that would become the president. But
look, there's an understandably educated conversation about, hey, what do we do about people that are truly destroying humanity? How can we allow them to continue to exist in a society that's trying to grow and progress? I think that, you know, it's one thing to have it as a theoretical conversation. It's another thing when it's like, okay, well, this guy's straight up just murdering white women. What do we do about him? Hang him up, you know, thumb down, murder this person. And, you know, the main question I want to bring to you, Toby and Simeon, is what did Diane do? Okay. How did she make this poor Vermont good old boy into the murderer he became? What's going on with these white women in Washington that are rich and they Simeon, in the last five decades, Diane said nothing. Not once was she ever like, well, once when we were making love, I did mention, I bet you couldn't strangle a woman. Not once, Diane. You can't let it out. You know, they went batting practice one day and Diane's like, ugh, you swing like a dumb little bitch. Not just one thing that she could have let the people know. I'm not denying Bundy ain't a piece of shit. I'm just saying, what did Diane do?
I think, Yogi, I think you make a point, but you're also working out your own things here. And, you know, we're a forum for that kind of thing. I think, you know, we're open to it. It's a therapeutic community. But
I'm just trying to prevent more Bundys in the future, Toby. You might look at me like a man scarred by his past. I'm just an individual protecting the future generation. I'm like the innovators of today. I'm allowing myself to access the powers of the people, like the Medici family, to empower me to protect the future of tomorrow. Because the world, they don't understand, you know? Nobody's asking these Diane Edwards these questions. We're not studying the water in the Pacific Northwest. We're not looking at the Puget Sound. We're focusing on these nuances, but we're not looking at what's most important, you know? And they need to talk to people like me, because as a college dropout myself, I identify with the frustration of a modern man and a man like Bundy, you know?
I just want to know, who's going to let this touring comedian, who's going to be the Medici family and let this touring comedian have his TED Talk and is going to save these young men? On the Jennifer Murray podcast, actually, one of the things we mentioned is that everyone kind of, so a lot of people have the capacity for this kind of thing. It's not like people like Ted Bundy aren't human. They're human, but things happen to them in their lives. And I think Yogi's brought up a really important point here. You know, who's going to stop like young men like this meeting women like this and then leading them onto that path? I think that's an important story. I mean, you can't deny it.
I think you have to say it's Donald Trump, because he prevented Hillary Clinton from winning. And Hillary and I, do we know that Hillary was not Diane? That Diane and Hillary are not the same person?
We don't know this. This is a good point.
They what? So 76, that's the year that Trump was born. And Clinton. Oh, so wow. So Hillary could be Diane.
Look, a lot of people are connecting dots that I never even knew were there, and I have to say, I'm just putting the facts out there. At the end of the day, whether or not Ted Bundy could be saved, we all can prevent. If you're dating a Scorpio and you're gonna dump them, just understand the consequences of your actions. I'm not saying you got to be with them forever. I'm just saying let them down a little easier than you should.
Astrology is like, it's a little faulty, because I checked on Twitter, I checked Virgo men, and it's like why are Virgo men like this, and like people should stop Virgo men dating. Like, what's the good astrology sign for men? Like, it seems like all of these signs, like
Toby, the whole system is built to destroy men. Don't you understand? This is why astrology is built for the feminine ideology, because it allows them to build biases against people for no reason. You know, Diane must have said some shit like, you a Scorpio, all you gotta do is be angry and wanna fuck, and I ain't trying to be with no broke ass bitch like that. I'm telling you, Diane broke this man's spirit, and at the end of the day, she is not to blame. But her actions need to be studied at places like MIT. It got to be studied at MI5. They've got to be looked at under a microscope, or we won't prevent the future Ted Bundys of the world. I'll give a TED Talk on Ted Bundy's first girlfriend, Diane. I'll do it.
There should at least be a class at, was it Puget or whatever it is. I mean, that's where it came from. There should at least be a class there. Oh, on Diane and you know, the female can have on male psychology in its formative stance,
and keep this guy from taking over the United States and putting the British in charge again.
No, absolutely. And Simeon, just to go back to was it a true American is invisible?
Yeah.
To this poetic beginning that you had, how are you reflecting on all of that now?
Well, you know, as I said, I think he still haunts the U.S. today, and then you can see that in the recent documentary. But I think also, you look at the 70s in particular, this is a time where I think what he's saying is kind of true, that and this is still true, but it was starting to be true then, that the community idea of America was being replaced by a new idea where individuals go out in the public and they put on a face in order to be successful. Mm-hmm. And they maybe were more going on under the face than Ted Bundy, who was just the face. He wasn't really, I think, a person, really. Just the psychopaths aren't really, some in some cases. But they judge each other by that public face. And that's how you're seen publicly in the public world in some ways. And I think he will like Bundy. Maybe he will realize two things. One, they're not safe, even when they think they are. And two, to quote a character in Game of Thrones, we're all liars here. And it, when you go out in the public and you're just trying to you know, you're you put on a face to be part of a world where everyone else puts on a face, you're really just, you're lying, everyone's a liar. And that's what I think, what he started to see that was kind of true about the world that was starting to happen, and that even more in the 80s, where it's all just about money and about putting on your face. And everyone, to some degree, who puts on a public face, rather than being themselves, is making themselves invisible, is a true American, as Bundy saw it. I think there's truth to what he said. I think when the psychopaths, they don't see the whole truth, but they see a version of it. They see it, a skewed version.
Yeah.
And to me, I think that he showed people a little bit of truth about the even though he was a pathological liar, even though he was, not a trustworthy person, in his own egotistical way, he saw a little bit about the world that was starting, that was changing, because America before then had money that was kind of in particular families, in particular pockets. And suddenly suddenly you have this post-war thing where, you know, where it's a little different. There is a little bit more things opened up, but at the same time, there is, the people who are willing to really be successful are those who are willing to make themselves invisible and put on a face.
I think there's somewhat of the American Psycho in this story, you know.
American Psycho is clearly based on Ted Bundy.
Yeah, we just sort of the main character, you know, he's creating this artifice for himself of wealth, in the financial sector, but his true self is this like murderous person who will like kill homeless people on the street and has no real connection to anyone. His real self is invisible, anatomized, and it's almost like the Son of Sam story is different because you have someone who is lonely and atomized and lives in the city and isn't able to connect with people and retreats and then explodes. But you have, in this circumstance, you know, going away from the 1960s and the we generation into the 1970s and the narcissism that takes over, the culture of narcissism. Someone like Ted Bundy, whose formative experiences really cordoned off from other people, he doesn't really relate to other people. He relates to kind of dominant people who dominate people and then sophisticated and special people, and is only able to build a connection with people through almost like a lizard-like thinking and planning and cultivating. And yeah, there is a real invisibility to his real self. And then, you know, his real self actually is the reptile that lies under all of this. And he does kill people in the same way that people die in American Psycho as well. It is interesting because it's quite sad. It's a quite sad story, not only in its contents and all the poor people who are murdered, but also for what it reveals about the American story in the 1970s and into the 1980s. I think
to piggyback on what Simeon said, where he briefly mentioned serial killers seeing the truth but not the whole truth, perhaps I'm wrong, but to me it seems, and feel free to say I'm talking out of my ass if I am, it feels like Ted Bundy understands what people of the class above, both in terms of old money, because like all that entire old money aristocratic type of person kind of dies around the Bundy time, and Bundy looks at it and goes, those people aren't better than me, and challenges the system in his way, which is murdering people and doing whatever the fuck he wants, which is a very American Psycho-esque way of going about it. But I do think that if there's any point or if there's any sanity in his madness, it's that he's like, the people that are better than me, they're not. They're just in better positions than I am.
Yeah, and there's a lot of resentment that he enacts on those people as well. And like you say, I mean, there wasn't there that Ross Douthat article, The Death of the Wasp or whatever. Like, the Wasps are kind of, they kind of go out of fashion, or in the 1970s, they're either sublimated into the broader American story, or, you know, like other groups, other immigrant groups start to like get in and take over the professional managerial class. There's like, yeah, it is kind of like an attack on them as well, I think.
But the weird thing is about that is, though, is that in some ways the reason it's effective that way is actually not intentional, because if you look at the way Ted Bundy acted, the type of people he tried to imitate were the Wasps. He tried to pass himself off as this sort of like, as this blue-blood Wasp guy when he wasn't, because he looked up to those people. He just thought that he should be the, he should have that kind of worship, and he could if he was just seen properly. But the thing is that he tries
One thing, just to disagree with you a little bit, like Kemper, you know, Kemper killed the people out of resentment, but other people have killed like people that no one cared about, like Dean Corll. Like, he killed like random runaways. It wasn't like Bundy was like, I'm a Wasp, I'm gonna kill, you know, working class people or whatever. He didn't do that. He killed the children of the professional managerial class, like Kemper did.
Well, because he, like Kemper, both of them, you know, in some ways, I mean, they had different motivations, but both of them wanted the high, you know, particularly Bundy, wanted the highest class of possession. He thought, well, they look at women as possessions, you know, they wanted the highest class of prey as predators, and those other people were just predators. But I think what Bundy was, it was more about trying to get his way in any way into the esteem and into the class and of those people. And he just saw them as that they own things. That's what makes them so great. They own things. So I'll own these girls. I'll kill them and I'll own them because I'll have special depositing places for them, like Kemper did. And that's what he wants. He wants to have the highest caliber possessions. And the thing is, I wonder if what happens in the Bundy case is that you see a guy who imitates these people, who wants to be like these people, and kills their children, and just shows how ridiculous, you know, I mean, shows the that what happens when you know it. I mean, I wonder, maybe he helped kill the Wasp aspirational thing, because no one is going to aspire to be a Wasp in the same way after Bundy does it. You know, no one is going to. Bundy also changes America in that he becomes suddenly the boy next door, who's, you know, looking guy, could be the guy who's going to kill and rape you. It's not just this other thing. I wonder, maybe part of this is that he kind of, in trying to be the Wasp, he killed the reputation of Wasp, of all people trying to be a Wasp in the future, or them as this idea to be achieved. Instead, and also in the 70s and 80s, you have new types of cool people that become, or they replace them.
The yuppies replace them.
Yeah,
but well, I think we're going to be wrapping this episode up now, unless anyone has anything else to add.
This is just a small afterthought. You know, some people did think this dude was mad fuckable, right? Even in the court cases, they were like, women, they were like, I think he's damn fine, right? And it's like, I don't know, maybe this is a more revealing about myself, but if you told me there's a, whatever you two both think is a good looking person, man, woman, even the audience can participate, whatever you think is an above average looking individual, whether it's in your life or if it's in media, whatever, if you told me, oh fuck, They're going around killing people. Oh, who are they killing? Other good-looking people. As a verified ugly person, a part of me goes, good for them. I don't give a fuck. This shit ain't hitting me at all. Let me know when they hunting fat brown dudes with man titties. Then I'm scared. As long as it's good-looking people killing good-looking people, my hands are clean. I'm doing the Vegas, like, when the dealer leaves, they kind of do that handshake thing. That's what I'm doing right now. I'm like, hey, you know what?
I have to say, Yogi is a verified above average looking person. But something must have happened to him in Washington State.
I'm telling you, Toby, these fucking white women from Washington State will break your heart in a million pieces.
Oh, man.
I didn't need to listen to 808s and Heartbreaks. I fucking lived that shit.
All these like comedy and acting headshots, guys. You know, you should check it out. But yeah. From myself, from Yogi, from Simeon, and from Ted Bundy himself. See you on the next episode, and stay safe. And goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.